Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 305 of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Adam. Jill is still in Seattle at the American Library Association Midwinter Conferences, so you just have me for the intro. Today's episode is an interview I did with Sarah Smarsh, who wrote a book called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah is from Kansas, and she resides there currently and has been there most of her life. She is a journalist, and her book is a finalist for the National Book Award and the Kirkus Prize. It's wonderful. It tells her family's story of generations of poverty and struggle as farmers, and just takes a look at life in middle America that oftentimes gets overlooked. If you are a longtime listener, you may remember that we interviewed Matthew Desmond about his book, Evicted. And this kind of conjures up the same thoughts and ideas. We connected really well because the city I'm originally from is a small factory city on the coast of Lake Erie that is unfortunately kind of dying because the factories and steel mills have all closed. And so the situation that my city is in is very similar to the situation about where she grew up. And we had a really great conversation about the way that politics are affecting this country and the miscommunication that's out there and just the tragic lives that people live that go unnoticed because a lot of times people don't want to pay attention to them. So it's a little heavy, but it's really a really great conversation. And the book is even better. Again, it's called Heartland. It's like, can't recommend it highly enough. If you have thoughts on this episode or any episode, you can always email us at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com, and you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds. You can also visit our website, professionalbooknerds.com, where we have all sorts of great information and fun stuff going on there. So I hope you guys borrow, buy, track this book down, whatever you have to do to read it. It's important and timely and powerful, and Sarah is one of the journalistic defining voices of our time, so I hope you will check it out. So without further ado, I'm going to get to the conversation I had with Sarah here on the Professional Book Nerds podcast. Hi everyone, it's Adam again, and I am incredibly excited to be joined today by Sarah Smarsh, a journalist who has covered socioeconomic class, politics, and public policy for some of the largest publications in the world. Her recent memoir, Heartland, was an instant bestseller and was selected as a National Book Award finalist for nonfiction, among and some other things. And I didn't say this before we started talking, before we started recording, but you're also probably the smartest person I follow on Twitter. So Sarah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Adam, and that is high praise. Thanks.
I literally will say when your post is sent through the pitch to chat with you, I got very excited. I was like, oh my god, that's like one of the people that I go to for intelligent political conversations on Twitter. So I was very, very excited. Can you maybe kick us off by giving our listeners a little bit of background in your memoir, Heartland, just so they have an idea of what we're going to be getting into today?
Sure. So Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth, is my first book. And it's really a family tale about my coming of age among many generations of what we might call the working poor in rural Kansas. I grew up on a wheat and cattle farm 30 miles west of Wichita. And the book also seeks to comment on the big picture of the economic and political forces that shape the private experiences of a family. And so in that way, it's not quite a classic memoir, but it's definitely rooted in a personal story.
And a lot of the topics that you write about in your memoir, in the book, there are things that you very frequently report on and write, you know, long-form pieces or short-form pieces, but certainly not to the length of a book. So what made you want to write this much kind of longer version of the story now?
Well, this is an interesting question because I began work on this book, believe it or not, and it, lest your listeners think that the book project was contrived for this particular political moment where class is, you know, suddenly at the fore of national discourse. I got my first research grant to work on this book when I was 22 years old in 2002 as a senior in college at the University of Kansas. So I really, my entire professional career as a journalist had this project in a drawer. Many of those years I was too broke to have the time and resources necessary to give it my full attention. But I always knew I was going to write about my family. Now, I sensed as a first generation college student in particular that there was something about my family that was different in the context of culture and politics and society, that in a way that my country was not articulating when I was a young person, and that had everything to do with class, which we're just now sort of reckoning with as a nation. And along the way of my work as a journalist, those 15 plus years that I was trying to accomplish the book project, I gained a language and an understanding for articulating why my family's story might matter. So, you know, why now about the book? I suppose that really what happened is the book was always there, and the timing right now is just that, like, the country was ready for it in more recent years. I spent like 10 years not being able to get a literary agent. They would read the passages from this book and be like, oh, you've got a way with a turn of phrase, but why does this matter? And and now we're at a moment, I guess, where the United States is ready to talk about it.
That's so interesting that you say that, and it kind of leads into something I was really curious about. And I told you this before we started recording, but, you know, when the book was released, it hit incredibly close to home for me. I grew up in this really small city called Lorain. It's outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and it's on the shores of Lake Erie, and it's a factory town with a failing steel mill, and you'll see all these multi-generational families struggling with the closure of the steel mill and a bunch of failing industries, unfortunately. And so I get, when you released this book, I get why it resonated so much with me, but I'm curious why you think it did resonate so much with people who may not have kind of similar backgrounds to you and I. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that, like you said, class is such a prevalent thing in the, you know, national discourse now, but why is it, do you think, that people from different backgrounds are finally ready to hear stories like this and maybe have a better understanding?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is that we are at such a moment of historic wealth inequality and economic disparity that they, even middle-class folks who, to my eyes as a kid, appeared flat-out wealthy, are in their own lives experiencing the class struggle of this country, and often a downward mobility rather than an upward, which is the American dream. And so there's something sadly universal about that subtitle of my book that involves working hard and being broke in a country that has plenty of resources seemingly to go around. And so I hear from people who maybe had more than I did in material terms growing up, but nonetheless have that sense of not being fairly compensated for their labor. But even apart from economics, you know, I think there are a lot of angles of the book that maybe aren't often touched upon in contemporary literature, from like rural life. There's, you know, while I think the population of the country is only like 16% rural, there are a whole mess of people, and probably, you know, that's a higher percentage of that who are only one or two generations away from the farm. Maybe they're the generations that moved to the city. That so-called rural flight has been happening for 100 years, but it's a phenomenon that we don't talk about very often, in part because people who come from those places are less likely to end up with some sort of national platform to be heard. And so that's a piece of the puzzle I hear a lot of people say they connect to. And also, you know, gender. There's sort of the way that the news media that I'm part of has portrayed the working class would suggest that it's all white male conservatives. And I think that my book makes more space for, while I am a white woman, there is, you know, a stronger female component to the story I tell, for obvious reasons. And also I tried to make sure that along the way of telling my story that I was giving due attention to people of color and indigenous tribes who, you know, are always experiencing these class issues in complicated ways and intersectional ways that people who have purported to speak for the white working class have kind of artfully ignored, I think.
Man, there's so much in that answer I want to unpack. I'm just sitting here thinking about all of the various types of people who your story would resonate for. Not only people who, you know, come from a rural background. I was just thinking while you're talking about how there's this, you know, it's almost like a running meme now on Twitter about, you know, making fun of millennials and younger people that are part of the work class who don't, you know, people say that they are so, you know, they don't appreciate what they have and all these things. And meanwhile, there's people, you know, my age and younger and a little bit older that are working two and three jobs and doing freelancing on the side and just to make ends meet. And I imagine the people that, you know, even if they come from a, you know, an inner city and they had a good upbringing, that they're still probably struggling. And, you know, even those types of people can appreciate this story of someone who was able to kind of, you know, break the cycle, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
I'm curious, a really big part of your story is that your family was pretty nomadic between your grandmother and your mother. They moved around a whole bunch. And I was reading about the countless different places that they lived and the different schools that you attended and your, you know, the people in your family attended. I was thinking about, there's a book called Evicted by Matthew Desmond. I don't know if you had a chance to read it last year.
Sure, yes.
Okay, so we had a chance to sit down and talk with him last year, and he talked a lot about this kind of transient lifestyle that people who are impoverished have to live because of all of the times they get removed from their housing, and it creates this vicious cycle where these people don't have the ability to put down roots anywhere, and so there's generation after generation of people who kind of disassociate themselves with the society they're a part of. You know, I feel like the difference obviously is Matthew was writing about inner city stories of poverty, but how do you think this kind of transient life, like how do you think it's affecting farming towns and maybe like these flyover states that people don't think about unless they live there?
Yeah, gosh, what an important question, because I think a lot about place as a factor of American identity that I think is often overlooked. As one might guess that from the title of my book being literally about a place or an area, there's a few things I want to say about that. First, I'm a fifth generation Kansas farm kid on my dad's side of the family, and that's where the farm experience and a deep rootedness comes from in my family story, and that's part of the book. On my mother's side of the family, though, they were mostly women who grew up in the Wichita area, not a bustling metropolis by, New York City standards, but it's nonetheless the biggest city in Kansas. And so they sort of thought of themselves as city women, and their version of poverty was very much more, looked a lot more like what Matthew Desmond wrote about. Mm-hmm. But this is, you know, I wrote about my mother and grandmother's experiences of, you know, just, you know, there's a constant changing of addresses, like within 2 square miles, and thus my mom would change school districts 3 times in a year, and that had to do with eviction notices. It had to do with sometimes as women fleeing dangerous men. There are all sorts of reasons that which the book Evicted does a great job of articulating. As far as how that plays out in the rural space now, I think that. When I was a child in the 80s, this is when I think we first began talking as a nation about the quote unquote farm crisis, and you would hear family farms are going under, they're dying, and that was the context of my childhood, being born and growing up in a place that people would refer to as dying. Mm-hmm. In economic terms. We held on to our farm until I was in college in the late 90s, but that was beating the odds in many ways. And so really the relationship between rootedness or like getting booted out of your home in rural places has a lot to do with the forces of corporate agriculture, big ag, federal policy that favors mass production over the small family farm, and so it's a very different version of what happens in the city, but it is similarly, you know, essentially economic forces making it impossible or untenable for people to remain in the place that they consider their home, whether it's the actual physical structure of a house or the land that they have owned. And it looks different, but there are certainly parallels. And I think that this is has a lot of very dangerous repercussions for society. One is that it is just incredibly taxing upon those good, productive people contend with that sort of psychological and economic stress of being uprooted and moved around. But then it also just, as you said in your question, it detaches or removes people from just a sense of community. And mm-hmm. I think that's dangerous for democracy, because when people don't have time or even physical presence to be engaged in civic action or community decisions or any sense of participating in the fabric of their local area, that leaves real vulnerability for outside forces and nefarious forces to come in and impact those decisions.
It's so interesting the way that you've framed that, because I think when a lot of people who may be unfamiliar think of like farm life, in my mind, I always just assume that other people think that it's basically like a Norman Rockwell painting, or like what people consider farm life is really just like those few moments when what feels like 80% of people go to a farm in the, you know, in the fall and go like pick apples or something like that. Like, but when in reality, that is just not that's not how, you know, farmers and people who, you know, have small farms and are a part of small farm communities, that's not how they live their lives at all. Like you said, it's being encroached upon constantly by this big agriculture, and it's really a lost, almost like a lost kind of, I don't want to say civilization, because that's a bit big, but it is. It's like a lost version of a part of what made this country.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's a writer I admire very much, Wendell Berry, who is an activist and kind of philosopher as a farmer in Kentucky, writes a lot about exactly that, as he calls it, you know, agrarian life. And I think he would say that we could rebuild that, you know, if you want to call it a civilization proper, but at the moment, you know, we've for at least decades and maybe more have been making decisions as a country that devalue that space so much that it is, there's still certainly those like earthy beauties to be had when you talk about the Norman Rockwell vision of it, but there are aspects of that in my upbringing that I'm so grateful for, but it was also a bunch of like, you know, chemical companies telling us it was safe to douse our earth in something that we later found out it wasn't, and just you know, it's a dangerous and often in modern terms toxic life, and then often those people are held accountable for the sins of the industry that really, as far as I'm concerned, happen at the very top, and then farmers like the ones I grew up with are the workers that catch hell for it.
So speaking of, you know, how you grew up, and, you know, people who read your book will know, and like you just mentioned, you're a fifth generation, you know, farmer, you know, as where you came from. And I'm curious, and apologies if this is like a massive question, but how did you manage to kind of personally, you know, break that cycle? Like, was there something early on in your life that sparked in your brain like a yearn to kind of change the path that your family line had been on for so many generations?
Yeah, you know, when we're kids, I think it's hard to know why or how certain things happen at the psychological level. But I do know this much. When I was a kid, I was just I think whatever predisposition led me to become a writer, and this would have been true regardless of where and how I grew up, but I was just, because of my nature, always looking around and observing in a way that when I look back, it occurs to me, it made me different from most of the kids around me. So I was, you know, just very, I was always observing, and I think that that kind of just surveying my environment and collecting information in that sort of way, it gave me the first step necessary to, you know, break some cycle, which is to discern that there's a cycle to begin with. So I sensed as a child, I understood somehow, okay, there have all these generations of my family have these recurring themes of alcoholism, teen pregnancy, not finishing high school. And I had just the vaguest sense that if I wanted to have some, like a different outcome in my life than some of them did in terms of undesirable outcomes, then I would, I should do something different. I should somehow make different choices or seek to have a different input in order for the output to look different. And you know, I was also a very bookish kid, and the path that our democracy offers for a child like me to have a different sort of life would be public education, and I was very well suited for that particular path because I was an academic bookish kid. So I think that sort of mix of factors was to my benefit if the goal was to have a different life than my family. But I want to add that my goal was never, you know, I appreciate so much that when you asked that question, you didn't say, how did you get out? Because that was never, you know, I don't like that framing because it was never that I didn't want to live where I'm from. In fact, I'm talking to you from Kansas right now. It's still my home, even though I've lived in some other places along the way. But I didn't want to get out. I didn't want to be poor, and mm-hmm. I didn't want to work my butt off in a way that was not fairly compensated, and I didn't want my day-to-day job to poison me and threaten my life in very mortal ways, and that's true for the vast majority of my family and has been for generations. That's what I wanted to get out of. It wasn't my home or my place, and so what I seek to do with my book is look at this troubling situation we've created in the country where just for economic survival, people have no choice but to leave their home. And then that has created all sorts of like political and economic and cultural imbalances that, you know, I always want to be mindful of when I answer questions like that.
Okay, so I'm actually glad you brought that up because I knew that you know, you're from Kansas and still residing in Kansas. So I know we've talked about 20 minutes of really heavy stuff, but I'm just curious, what's like a common misconception that people have about Kansas, or maybe people from Kansas that you want to dispel?
Well, I would have to say in the last 10 years, we most often have made national headlines for, you know, a really far right legislature and governor. And so and probably the biggest misconception right now would be in the political realm. And I think that we have such a reductive way of talking about politics in the country that, you know, we say red state and blue state. Mm-hmm. And you look at this graphic on CNN and it would suggest that half of the country is just teeming with all conservatives and the other half is all liberals. And of course, that's not how it looks on the ground at all. And Kansas is a place that, like many, due to various factors, including who does and doesn't vote, has had a state-level government that didn't necessarily represent the majority of its people for quite a few years. That political tide has been turning the last couple of years with a more moderate legislature, and we just elected an incoming Democratic female governor and sent first Native American woman to Congress from our third congressional district. And so I think that Kansas on the ground is a more politically diverse place than people would think.
Yeah, you sure did do that. I remember like watching on election night specifically, like they kept going to the Kansas races. That was impressive. I think you're right. I think there's so many misconceptions because of, like you said, when someone sees red state, blue state, you know, red county, blue county, there's, and I know what a lot of it has to do with how we ingest media now, because we get mm-hmm. these like short bursts, whether it's from social media or just people just reading headlines and only going to the places that, you know, lean the way that they lean. So they assume it's one end of the spectrum or the other. But I feel like a lot of times the only moments we really have to realize things aren't a certain way really is like election night, when it's cut and dry. Like, no, look, these particular people voted this particular way, and it was a really close margin. And I just think a lot of that has to do with how we are ingesting media.
Yes. Yeah, very well said. And I, you know, along the way of my commenting on socioeconomic class in this country, I often find that I have occasion to be a kind of media critic as a member of the journalism industry mm-hmm. who takes issue with exactly what you just said. And I think that we can do better in the way that we frame the conversation and the questions that we ask often are like the root of the problem in our misperceptions of ourselves as a country. And a lot of that has to do with the conflict-driven nature of profit-motivated corporate media. But it's a big problem to solve. So I'm always, that's why I love books, and I love book people, because they tend to value nuance rather than just very simple, reductive conversations. And I do think that that's like at this crisis moment in our country, nuance and deep story rather than just quick sound bites is the only way we're going to right the ship.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, especially I can't even imagine as a female, you know, kind of political journalist in the media who, like I said, has a substantial social media presence. Like, I can't imagine the messages that you get from people, because it's just, you know, people go and they see the political commentators they want to watch on the news. And then the only time they interact with people from the other side is if they see a headline that you would write out, you know, on maybe you send out a tweet, and I just imagine them not clicking through, not reading the facts, and instead just being, in general, pretty horrible because they think they have that, you know, shade of anonymity on social media.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. You're right about that.
Yeah, that wasn't even a question so much as just like, sometimes I just feel like I need to apologize for people who have a platform. Just be like, I don't know why I'm apologizing, but I just feel like someone deserves to give you an apology.
Oh, very kind of you. I don't hold you accountable for their actions, but thanks.
Well, thanks. So I actually want to get into one other thing. I know that, you know, your book was selected by Sarah Jessica Parker for the ALA Book Club Central Book Club. Mm-hmm. So what was that kind of feeling like as someone who obviously is so well-read and so, cares so much about books and things like that? What was that kind of moment like, seeing that your book was selected for the Book Club Central Book Club?
Well, I was over the moon, of course, and for various reasons, but the first being that, you know, I write about economic inequality, and often that involves kind of the political tension in this country between private and public spheres. And I, as a kid who grew up not having much in a material way and not steeped in books in the context of my family and my community, I don't come really from like a strong book culture. My mom was a reader, but I say that because you know, it wasn't for lack of intellect or curiosity that those folks didn't have houses full of books. It was for lack of money and the economic and socioeconomic cultural factors that determine whether people can go to, you know, like an independent bookstore and pay full price for a big thick book or not. And so libraries were extremely important to me as a kid. Being in a rural area, I didn't have close proximity to them, but when I got the chance to go, it was a magical experience where you know, it wasn't like my experience being in a store where everything I looked at, my in immediate understanding was, you can't have that. I didn't even bother to ask. But in a library, you can have anything. And I just think that that is such a an incredible gift to our democracy. And so that Sarah Jessica Parker picked my book for a book club, a national book club project that is rooted in and promoted by the American Library Association, just had a real it touched me deeply mm-hmm. in that way. And I'm also just excited, you know, that her celebrity and platform means that more people will come to the story.
I will say, and your book included, Sarah Jessica Parker has a pretty good eye for books, man. The books she's been picking the past year or so, and the publication house that she's kind of creating, she's got a good list of, she's got a good eye to her when it comes to literary things.
Oh, yes. I feel like I've been put in very good company. No doubt about that.
Okay, so we like to end our podcast with what we call the Nerd Nine. They're just nine lighthearted questions, almost the opposite of what we just spent the last half hour talking about. Kind of like a palate cleanser, I suppose. So the first one is, what's the last book you finished reading?
The last book I finished reading was The Art of Loading Brush by Wendell Berry, mm-hmm. Which is very much about local economies, and it's rooted in kind of agricultural conversation, but I think it's relevant to our big picture.
Do you have a favorite place to read?
Favorite place to read would definitely be my cushy sofa in the living room, because if I can't read in bed, I no matter how good it is, I fall asleep. Mm-hmm. This is no criticism of the author. I just can't do it.
Do you remember the book that kind of made you fall in love with reading when you were a kid?
Yeah, I do. And, well, it might be overreaching to say that, because I had already loved many books, but I remember being deeply struck by Laura Ingalls Wilder's books when I was a kid, mm-hmm. Probably for obvious reasons, because it's about a little girl on the prairie in Kansas, mm-hmm. and that was, you know, in a very different time, my identity as well. And so, yeah, I would say A Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah. What's one place you would like to travel that you have not yet been to?
I have never been on the continent of Asia, so which is quite vast, of course, and I'd love to go anywhere on it.
There you go. Do you have a favorite holiday to celebrate?
Favorite holiday is probably Halloween.
Okay. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Cats or dogs?
Whew, that's tough, but I'm going to edge out with cats.
Okay. How about a favorite food?
Here in Wichita, Kansas, we have an incredible Mexican cuisine. Lots of folks from that neck of the woods in Kansas through various industries. So any Mexican food.
Okay. That's really interesting. Where I'm from, we have a massive Puerto Rican culture. And so I also lean towards Latin American food. Interesting.
Awesome.
And then if you could have dinner with one person, dead or alive, who would you pick?
Oh my gosh, this is probably, you know, in the 21st century, a very cliche response to this, but I'm going to go with Barack Obama, and I'll tell you why, because like me, he had a working class mom from Wichita, and he was largely raised by his working class Wichita grandparents, and I wouldn't be so bold as to claim we have any other similarities, but I admire him deeply, and I feel like he might even dig my book, so he'd be my dream dinner date.
Listen, it's not as cliche as you think, because all the times we've asked this, Michelle actually has been named more times than Barack, so it's not that cliche.
All right, well, I wouldn't turn her down, I can say that.
That's fair. Okay, last question for you. What do you hope that readers take away from reading Heartland?
Well, I think that'd be kind of two sides of the same coin. One would be if it's readers for whom the place and class I have described feel very familiar, then I would hope that they feel a sense of validation or dignity in the way they've been represented that perhaps is too often lacking in pop culture and literature. And for readers for whom that place and class feels quite foreign and like nothing they've experienced firsthand, I would hope they might find more complexity and nuance about the characters and places described that might do a little bit of stereotype busting in their minds.
That's perfect. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today. This was phenomenal.
This was great, Adam. Thanks for the good questions.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from Overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections and marketplace.
Hey guys, time to get in on the action for the biggest moments in basketball with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projections, place your entry, and win up to 100 times your money. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use the code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.